Today, in our series, Three Books, we're going to hear about writing. The recommendations come from Jonathan Gottschall, who says he has a list of books that will help you write well.
I'm an English professor. For the first 15 years of my career, I tried to write like one. It might surprise you what that's like. We preach to our students, good writing is simple and direct, but we don't practice that. We're notorious for mazy sentences and ugly jargon. We don't attract readers with prose. We smack them over the head with a sign that says, "Look how smart I am." A few years ago, I started writing for general readers, not just PhDs. I needed to unlearn my worst habits. Here are three books that helped me change. They're also fun to read. In his book on writing, A Memoir of the Craft, Stephen King tells us how to make stories work, and he shows us too, using tales from his own life. His account of being hit by a speeding van is as violent and visceral as his best fiction. He tells us to toss material that doesn't work, even if we love it. He quotes the saying, "Murder your darlings." Then there's The Great Commandment. If you want to be a writer, King says, you must do two things above all others: read a lot and write a lot. For William Zinsser, clutter is the disease of American writing. It leaves us strangling in unnecessary words, circular constructions, pompous frills, and meaningless jargon. In his book, On Writing Well, he braids together good advice. There are mercifully lucid guidelines on punctuation and grammar. There are tips how to write about business, sports, science, technology. Zinsser follows Thoreau's famous teaching, simplify, simplify. Writers must rewrite and revise, razoring away everything showy, stripping language to its cleanest components. Advice to Writers, put together by John Winokur, is a collection of quotes. It's like the trench wisdom of generations of authors. Mark Twain, when you catch an adjective, kill it. Hemingway on persistence. He claimed to scrawl 91 clunky pages for every sparkler. Flaubert on the necessity of revision. Prose is like hair, he wrote. It shines with combing. This book takes the mystery out of the writing process. Accomplished authors just muddle their way toward something good. As the sports writer Red Smith once said, writing is easy. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and open a vein. You don't have to be an aspiring author to learn from these books. Writing is sweaty work, but on the best days you'll agree with the ancient Egyptian sage Ptah Hotep. Be a scribe, he said. Your body will be sleek. Your hand will be soft. Your servants answer speedily. Beer is poured copiously. All who see you rejoice in good cheer. Happy is the heart of him who writes. He is young each day.
Jonathan Gottschall is the author of the new book, The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human.
American attitudes toward the French tend to warm and cool depending on the news cycle, but stories about Americans in Paris somehow seem to stay in vogue. Author Rosecrans Baldwin has a particular favorite. It's called The Dud Avocado. He recommends it for our series You Must Read This, where authors talk about a book they love.
It's not always the case, but Americans are feeling pretty good about the French these days. Look at this year's Academy Awards. Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris, his top-grossing movie of all time, was nominated in four categories. Even more telling, this year's Best Picture statue went to a French film, The Artist, for the very first time. Granted, it took a film in which no French is actually spoken for the Gauls to bring home the gold. But if you're the type of person who's even once considered wearing a beret, I thoroughly recommend reading Elaine Dundy's first novel, The Dud Avocado. I picked it up when it was reissued in 2007 because of the cover, which featured a discreetly obscured nude woman, which is entirely appropriate. The Dud Avocado is the riveting story of a carbonated American girl thundering through Paris in the 1950s. Her name is Sally J. Gorse, and her default speed, as she puts it, is hell-bent for living. Basically, if you were to set Henry James's Portrait of a Lady near the Sorbonne, untangle the sentences, and add more slapstick, sex, and champagne cocktails, you're getting close. When we first meet Sally, she's bumming around the Boulevard Saint-Michel in an evening gown, because the rest of her wardrobe is at the laundry. Her hair's dyed red, part of her new Parisian look. Within 10 pages, she's gotten drunk, fallen in love with a boy at a cafe, and also run into her lover, an Italian diplomat who likes to buy her cocktails at the Ritz. The rest of the book finds Sally dodging trouble, tearing through nightclubs, going to jail, and getting mixed up with a slave trader in the south of France. As a rule, Sally says at one point, I'm rather fond of excitement. Sally is both a lush and an incurable romantic, which can become irksome. Due to the beauty of Paris, she's constantly floating off curbs and getting run over in traffic. But Sally is less hedonistic and more anti-boredom. She can't stand, she says, lazing around, not learning anything, not accomplishing anything, not seeing anything new. To me, that's a noble conceit, whether you live in Paris, France, Paris, Texas, or no Paris at all. When The Dud Avocado was first published, it was a smash. Groucho Marx sent her a letter. I had to tell someone, it might as well be you since you're the author, how much I enjoyed The Dud Avocado, he wrote. If this was actually your life, I don't see how the hell you ever got through it. When people asked Dundee how autobiographical the book was, she'd say, all the impulsive, outrageous things my heroine does, I did. All the sensible things she did, I made up. This novel is a candid portrait of a free-spirited life. Whether you're a Francophile with a Serge Gainsbourg tattoo or someone who prefers their steak frites with freedom fries, I bet The Dud Avocado will be your next favorite read.
Rosecrans Baldwin is the author of Paris, I Love You, But You're Bringing Me Down. You can comment on this essay at our website, npr.org. Just click on Opinion. Being a teenager is tough. There's pressure to fit in, along with pressure to stand out. And then, of course, there are those changing bodies. Well, writer Meg Wolitzer remembers one book that helped her endure those confusing years, and she's a little embarrassed to recommend it to us. But here it is, as part of our series, My Guilty Pleasure.
In reality, I may be a middle-aged woman with two nearly grown sons, but in my heart, I am a teenaged girl who has found herself pregnant and doesn't know what to do. For if you came of age, as I did, reading Paul Zindel's My Darling, My Hamburger, then you probably still feel that you know what it's like to be a high school student whose life almost derails. I sometimes take out my old copy of this book and have a look, not because it's a cautionary tale, the writing is too subtle, or because it speaks to today's young readers. In some important aspects, it seems dated, but because it reminds me of who I was when I first picked it up. I turn the first page and recall my goofy adolescent self with the Keith Partridge shag haircut and the huckapoo blouse and the orange-tinted lotion supposedly hiding, but really highlighting, a breakout on my chin. I was pretty nerdy, and I didn't have to worry that I would get pregnant like one of the novel's main characters, Liz, who is popular and beautiful and has sex with her boyfriend, Sean, then gets an illegal abortion. The character I could most relate to was Liz's less popular friend, Maggie. Like her, I enjoyed the excitement of being around someone cool, and I made friends with a group of kids who were definitely cooler than I was. Sometimes I would hang out at their houses, and we would order pizzas to be delivered to the house across the street. Occasionally, we made prank phone calls. When I did these dumb things, I was both mortified and thrilled. Scared to be seen as a bad girl, but desperate not to be entirely good, either. I liked the idea of being in the neighborhood of bad. Not the one who makes the call to the pizza place, but the one who listens in on the other extension. My adolescence coincided with a golden era in young adult fiction. It allowed slightly nerdy girls to imagine the excitement and catastrophes that might befall other girls who were more adventurous or just unlucky. While My Darling, My Hamburger is, for me, the best entry in this category, there are related books about teen pregnancy, mental illness, and even LSD that I occasionally reread, not because they are classics, but because they bring me back to my long outgrown self. These were the subjects I wanted to read about because they kept me wondering, What if it had been me? But they also kept me safely knowing it probably never would be. Now, thank God, it's way too late for me to be teenaged and pregnant or teenaged and falling in with a rough crowd. One of the fringe benefits of middle age is never having to think about being a teenager again. But some part of me likes to think about it. And when I do, I know exactly what to read.
Meg Wolitzer recommending the book My Darling, My Hamburger by Paul Zindel. Wolitzer is also the author of a book for young readers. It's called The Fingertips of Duncan Dorfman. And you can find more reading recommendations in our My Guilty Pleasure series at nprbooks.org.
The warming weather this time of year brings with it a growing sense of wanderlust. Thoughts drift to exotic locales, adventures abroad. We draw up itineraries, real and imagined, and wrestle with essential questions: what to wear, what to pack. Well, author Adam Wilson reminds us of another important consideration: what to read on those few precious vacation days. Here are a few of his recommendations for our series, Three Books.
Most people don't associate spring travel with heavy reading. For one thing, books are bulky luggage. Even an e-reader takes up space. And for another, people like to escape to mountaintops or flowery fields or seaside locales. Communing with nature is really a book-free activity. But what about your downtime? When it's raining outside your Puerto Rican bungalow or with your cappuccino in a Parisian cafe or on African safari when your cell phone's out of service? And then there are those of us stuck at home, tethered to work and family. Here are three books that are perfect for those times. Roberto Bolaño's The Savage Detectives begins in diary form. It's from the perspective of Juan, a 17-year-old Mexican poet, green around the gills and eager for experience. It's Mexico City in 1975. While Latin America storms with revolution, Juan is falling in love with a clan of young poets. The visceral realists are on a sort of permanent siesta, complete with passion, ideas, warm weather, and beautiful women. It's a charged and romantic time for them. Eventually, they drive off into the sunset. If the book ended here, it would feel nostalgic and sentimental. But the next couple hundred pages show the harsh fallout from that freewheeling period. It's a reminder that time touches everyone. Youth, like all holidays, can't last forever. Joy Williams' Breaking and Entering invites readers into the lives of Willie and Liberty. They're a young couple living like vagabonds on the Gulf Coast of Florida. They squat in unoccupied houses, dressing their blank lives in the clothing of strangers. But when the owners return, the couple has to hit the road. It's a funny book and breezy, but there's human drama, too. Williams has a gift for dialogue. Sadness lurks beneath the smiley dispositions. No amount of sun and surf can wash away a haunted past. Everything in this book really happened, but some of the things that happened only happened in my head. That's how Jeff Dyer introduces yoga for people who can't be bothered to do it. And thus, we're off on a whirlwind world tour. The cramped cafes of Amsterdam, Indonesia's most competitive ping-pong tables. We see Burning Man and the Roman ruins. Dyer ponders life's deepest questions. The book is funny, occasionally beautiful, sometimes scholarly, and usually under the influence of controlled substances. In the end, it doesn't matter whether it's fiction or nonfiction. It feels true. It's like your best friend telling you his favorite adventure story. This anti-travel book will leave you feeling like you were there on the journey. These three books grasp the spirit of spring travel. Read them anywhere, on the subway or in an airport terminal, on the couch or on the beach. You'll be instantly transported to a tropical adventure land where the wind whips the ocean and the heart beats a slow samba.
Adam Wilson is the author of the book Flat Screen. You can comment on this essay at our website. Go to nprbooks.org.
For many people, for many years, This woman was the face and the voice of the survivors of September 11th.
I was on the South Tower, and I lost my fiancé that day.
Tanya Head's inspiring story of courage in the face of impossible devastation captivated millions of people, and not a word of it was true. Tanya Head wasn't in the United States on September 11, 2001. Her name wasn't even Tanya. Our book today is The Woman Who Wasn't There, The True Story of an Incredible Deception. Authors Robin Gabby Fisher and Angela Guglielmo join me now from our New York bureau. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much, Guy.
Angela, let me start with you, because you were actually friends with this woman who called herself Tanya Head. Who was she? How did you meet her?
Tanya and I met each other while we were volunteering at Ground Zero to give tours of the Tribute Center. We became friendly right away. You know, she came up to me in our training session and told me her story right there. And I immediately burst into tears.
What did she tell you?
Well, she told me that she was on the 78th floor when the plane actually came towards the towers. She said she could see it so close that she could feel the air being sucked out of her lungs. She had gotten thrown across the room. She had passed out. She had seen incredible carnage surrounding her. Her arm got severed, and she miraculously made it to the doorway. And she was saved by Wells Remy Crowther. He was the man with the red bandana that was responsible for many people getting out of the towers alive. And he had died helping people escape. She got down to the sky lobby before the towers collapsed around her. She was thrown under a rig and woke up 6 days later as a John Doe in the hospital. So when you heard her story, I mean, you could just feel your heartache.
She said her fiancé was in the other tower and he was killed.
Yes. She actually, the first thing she thought about, she told me, was her husband Dave, who was in the neighboring tower. And she actually counted floors from the top of the tower out the sky lobby window to see that he was the floor that had gotten hit.
You decided shortly after you met her that you wanted to make a film?
Yes, well, I had made a 9/11 documentary about my volunteer experience at Ground Zero, and I wasn't really ready to make another movie again about that subject. I felt like I had said everything I had wanted to. Tanya wanted me to make a film not only about her, but about her work with the Survivors Network. And there was a lot of back and forth. I didn't want to film.
This is, we should say, an organization that she joined and became very prominent, a prominent part of.
Oh, yeah. The World Trade Center Survivors Network had just gotten started at that point, and Tanya had been instrumental in moving it forward and getting it noticed by basically everyone in the 9/11 community.
Angela, let me bring in your co-author, Robin Gabby Fisher, into the conversation, because, Robin, what struck me in the book was this idea that before it all unraveled, before we discovered this is a massive hoax, a lot of people said had said she helped them. She was really helping them, a lot of survivors and people who were traumatized by 9/11.
Survivors continue to say that a great deal of their healing came from Tanya helping them and from Tanya helping get them recognized. They needed that validation, and no one was able to get that for them except for Tanya.
She said that she was working for Merrill Lynch, and that's why she was at the World Trade Center. She also described to people, and presumably to you, Angelo, as well, about how she encountered a dying man who asked her to give his ring.
Oh, sure. She had said while she was crawling to the exit on the 78th floor, and crawling over bodies, people who were burned from head to toe and people who were cut up, she came across a man who put into the palm of her hand his wedding ring and his business card and said, "Please get this to my wife." And it was the last moments of his life at that point, she said.
And many people heard that story and were so taken with it, but nobody ever asked, what was the name of that person?
As everyone says, now looking back, there were so many questions they could have asked. But because of her story, even when they did have maybe little doubts, hints, they would immediately stop thinking about those things because how dare they question this woman who had been through so much? And after all, who would ever make up such a story?
She carried out this hoax for almost 6 years. How did the story begin to unravel?
The story began to unravel because the New York Times was looking for someone to profile for the 6th anniversary. And several people had told them that they should speak to Tanya because they never had. And so they began by trying to interview her, and she agreed. And then she canceled the interviews, and they went ahead and did their normal background checking. And as they did their background checking, just things started not to check out. And then when they called Merrill Lynch, and Merrill Lynch said they had no employees by that name, the whole focus of their story obviously changed.
What did they find out?
Well, what they did find out was that her real name wasn't Tanya Head at all, that she was actually not even in the United States on September 11th, 2001, and that the likelihood of her ever meeting her husband, who was a real person that had died in the towers, was a complete impossibility.
She was actually living in Spain at the time, right?
That's correct. She was in Barcelona, Spain, in graduate school, and told no one of having been in the towers or having suffered any injuries.
Angelo, when you saw this article in the New York Times, were you shocked, or by that point did you already have your own suspicions?
Well, we had known before the Times article came out because what was going on behind the scenes was significant for all of us and eye-opening. You know, it went from, why is the Times harassing her? Why is this reporter repeatedly asking her questions around the anniversary when she doesn't want to talk to him? To, why isn't she answering these questions? It's not like he's asking her questions that haven't been asked of her before. To, oh, you know, and then all of a sudden the truth just emerged.
And her real, remind us what her real name was?
It is Alicia Esteve Head.
What happens at that point? Did she just disappear?
I went up to her apartment the day that the Times article came out. I wanted to give her another chance to tell her side of the story. I felt like it was important for her. She obviously told me she would tell me her story one day, but not that day, and she never did. And you have to understand, it wasn't easy for us to shift focus, even though we knew that she wasn't the person that she said she was. That didn't change our attachment to her. I felt bad for her. I felt we were always trying to protect her. And here, the house of cards had already fallen, and we were still, some of us still tried to protect her.
How do either of you explain it? Why did she do it?
As soon as I started talking to Angelo about this story, I thought one of the most amazing and interesting things about the story was that she never took any money. And in fact, she gave money to the Survivors Network. And it was clear to me right away that she did it for the attention, for some crazy need to be a star. And that's what she wanted to be. And she became that.
That's Rob and Gabby Fisher, together with Angelo Guglielmo. They wrote the new book called The Woman Who Wasn't There. It's about one of the most famous cases of identity fraud to have come out of September 11th. Angelo, Robin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Guy. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Despite politics, debates, and doubts, religion plays a huge role in American life. This country is still the most religious country in the developed world. New York Times conservative columnist Ross Douthat has written a new book called Bad Religion, in which he makes the case that religion, American Christianity in particular, has fallen into heresy. Bad Religion has a feisty subtitle, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. Ross Douthat joins us in the studio. Thank you for coming in to talk about your book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you begin this book with an almost nostalgic eulogy for the great strength of Orthodox religion in the period after the Second World War. You suggest that the awful things that happened in that war sent us back to faith and that it was huge.
I mean, I think what happened in the U.S. after the Second World War was a large-scale popular revival of religion. Church-going rates rose to levels that hadn't been seen before or since. And simultaneously, in American politics, you had this remarkable thing, which was the emergence of the civil rights movement as a political cause that was really grounded in a kind of religious, almost revival spirit of its own.
A sort of Christian duty.
Right. In the civil rights era, much more than in our current culture war controversies, the various Christian churches ended up being relatively unified. Catholics, Protestants, even Southern evangelicals in the end essentially bought into the message of Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy and people like that.
Now, in your book, that is the mark from which we have fallen. And you make the point that this loss is important to all of us, to the pious and to the secular as well.
The eclipse of what I would say was a kind of Christian center that the country used to have has created a landscape where religion divides us much more than it used to. I think, you know, something really important has been lost, and you're left with this kind of ungrounded, perpetual do-it-yourself many forms of religion.
One of the most interesting sections of your book is about the heresies that you feel modern American faith has fallen into. The first one is sort of personified by Dan Brown, the author of The Da Vinci Code.
Right. So the heresies that I write about are what flourish in the vacuum that's left by institutional Christianity's decline. So if the country remains religious, but the institutional churches are weaker than they used to be, what steps into the breach, right? And I start with the project to fashion a Jesus who seems to fit the modern world better than the Jesus of the Nicene Creed, let's say. And this project is best embodied by Dan Brown and by the Da Vinci Code, which is a book that was a bestseller for a lot of reasons. It's a page-turner and everything else, but Brown himself is very explicit that he has a theological, philosophical message about what direction Christianity, what direction religion should go in, and that direction is towards this sort of alternative Jesus that he sketched out. And then from there, I move towards, heresies that are about money, basically, and about the idea that God wants you to get rich, which is not precisely the message of the New Testament. And so then from there I move to sort of what I call the God within, which is the heresy of Elizabeth Gilbert, Eat, Pray, Love, of Oprah Winfrey, of Deepak Chopra and Eckhart Tolle, and that the point of spiritual wisdom is not necessarily sort of, strenuous prayer and fasting and moral transformation. It's more sort of blessing impulses you already have and so on. And this ends up putting a kind of Christian stamp on narcissism, where the things we already want to do, we tell ourselves are things that God wants us to do too.
And then you get
and
to
then politics.
Glenn Beck.
To Glenn Beck. And there in the final chapter, I say that, one of the things that happens as institutional religion weakens is that people start investing religious energy in political figures and in political narratives, and that this has a sort of, I call it a messianic side, where you are sort of putting all your chips into some great leader who's going to usher in the kingdom of God on earth, which I think we saw a lot of in the enthusiasm for Barack Obama and the 2008 campaign and the sort of yes, we can idea. And then the apocalyptic side, where it's sort of the reverse. You're saying, well, the other party, is practically in league with the devil.
Ross Douthat is here talking about his new book, Bad Religion. Now, I have to say that some of these people to be pronounced heretics or leading people into heresy, I mean, that's making them very important.
I think they are very important. One thing I try and do, I think a lot of people who are at a distance from that world just laugh at prosperity preachers, right? It's like, the prosperity preacher with his fancy car who's telling everybody they're going to get rich. This is obviously absurd, and only fools could possibly believe it. But if you look at a figure like Joel Osteen, who is one of the best-selling religious writers in America today, and who is a much more sort of canny and subtle promoter of that message, it's a very powerful idea. But it's also a very, what's Jesus' message? It's take up your cross and follow me. That's a much harder message than, no, just pray a little harder and you'll be happy. You too can be happy. You too can be rich.
But you're not without hope.
No, I'm not without hope. I mean, Christianity is a 2,000-year-old religion. Christianity has been very resilient, and it's been very resilient. I mean, obviously, as a Christian, I think it's been very resilient because it's true. But I also think it's been resilient because there have been figures, whether it's a Francis of Assisi in the Middle Ages or both sort of Protestants and Catholics during the Reformation and Counter-Reformation and so on, who were willing to sort of sit in the rubble of an institutional failure and start working again. And where those people come from, I'm not sure. But they have appeared in the Christian past, and it's reasonable for Christians to hope they might appear in the future as well.
Ross Douthat's new book is called Bad Religion: How We Became a Nation of Heretics. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much for having me.